CMR Critical Mass Radio in association with We Are Change Manchester and Freedom Northwest. Please note the views and opinions expressed by the hosts on this show are not necessarily the views held by the station. CMR is for people who want answers, because now it's our turn.
Good evening, everybody. How are you? Hi, guys in the chat room. Lisa, Tutin, Rob, Gwen, Ken, all of you. Finally, we've got Andrew Johnson on the show. Obviously, last time was a complete nightmare with my DOS attack going on. That was fun. I had DOS media in my system. So we're here. We've got Andrew. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Sasha. How you doing?
Oh, it's good to have you on, mate. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, just a bit tired. I've been sort of work today and stuff. So, yeah, a little bit tired, but I'm okay.
Oh, we'll try not to keep you up too late. Right, well, I've been following your work quite avidly for, you know, quite a while now. Our mm-hmm. paths have crossed quite a few times, haven't we, with various things.
Yeah, but we've never met.
I know. No, not yet. I'm sure we will.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I'm now on this sort of truth juice, not bandwagon, but I've jumped on the wagon anyway.
Yeah,
about time. I think I needed to get out of Leeds, really, because it was a bit intense there. It's like some sort of bad EU experiment, you know what I mean?
Really?
yeah, it's like after 7/7 when all the property prices plummeted and no one could sell the houses or whatever, and all these properties were getting sold off to landlords who then just filled the place up with people from all over the world. And it seemed very convenient.
Yeah.
Turn of events, you know what I mean? So completely decimated an area, did that. And so anyway, we wanted to talk about chemtrails and Judy Wood's theory, and I'm quite sure we'll touch on other things as well. But what I wanted to start off with is that I keep being told that some of these trails are contrails and some of them are chemtrails. Mm-hmm. I say, well, what the hell difference does that make, really, if any of them are chemtrails? It's a bit of a false premise dismissal, I think, really. So can we cover briefly for these few people who are saying, well, what is the difference then? What is the difference between the chem and the con?
Yeah, well,
if there even is one.
Well, I could try, but I've been looking at this for since about 2005, and I'm still no nearer any good answers. But the sort of, you know, if we give the sort of definition, as it were, a contrail is just meant to be the trail that's left when an aircraft travels through the sky above a certain altitude. Now, depending on what you read, that altitude can vary, because obviously if you see a plane coming in to land at the airport, it ain't got a big sort of steamy trail coming out the back of it. And so that effect only occurs, you know, above a certain altitude, which as I understand it, under normal sort of conditions, is around about 26 to 28,000 feet in the atmosphere up in the air. So if your plane is travelling below about 26,000 feet, you ain't going to see a trail out of it, and that's the end of the story. Now, it would appear that under certain circumstances, you know, of course, air displays, you know, accepted for red arrows and those sorts of things and various aerobatics, you shouldn't see trails when aircraft are sort of coming into land, or you shouldn't really see them when they're being stacked near an airport waiting to land, because normally when you're stacked, I think you're up to about 15,000 feet. And the reason why aircraft travel, you know, so high is they use less fuel in doing that, because there's a balance between the thickness of the air and stuff, and you know, and things, and the air intake that's needed to give the plane lift and stuff like that. Essentially, really, as I understand things, when an aircraft is above 26,000 feet and you get one of these whitish coloured trails coming out the back, people say different things, but my understanding is that trail should not be seen in the sky for more than about 2 minutes. And as a kid, that's all I remember seeing. I remember looking at these things with binoculars. You'd watch the trails coming out, and you'd see this sort of wispy cloud fading away in this sort of unusual type of ghostly effect, you know, if you were just curious.
Funnily enough, I can remember asking my dad about that when I was little.
Right,
and he said the same thing. It's condensation. The cold.
That's it. And I mean, you do get a similar effect coming, you know, on a cold morning out of the exhaust of a car.
Yeah.
You know,
essentially, but it dissipates quickly, doesn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
I always say that if that effect were true, then when it's very cold outside, say with people who live in Alaska, maybe, if they stood still breathing for a moment, they would have a cloud around their head because it is the same effect. It's the condensation from the breath. So that's not going to happen, is it?
That's exactly the argument that I've used. I mean, I put that... Yeah. Not with people in Alaska, but I just... Yeah, you know, on a cold day here. I mean, it's been a bit Alaskan here over the last few weeks, hasn't it?
So. Yes, a little bit, yeah. But what I find interesting is, and I pointed this out to my sister a little while ago, because she wasn't really aware of all this sort of stuff, and there were five different planes, you know, going in five different directions, and each one had a spray coming out of it that behaved differently upon contact with the air. So he had the one that was breaking up like the XY chromosome, the big fat one, and the one that just sort of like, you know, takes a while to go, or, you know, and then the dusty one that just seems to sort of spread out as dust.
Right. So this is where the sort of mystery starts to begin when you start to study it, because as you say, you know, you can get circumstances, and I've seen this myself, and I've got one particular video which I show in, you know, some of the talks I've given, where you can see a plane travelling across the sky, and the trail is disappearing, as we described, you know, a couple of minutes ago, and then right alongside it, you'll see another plane, which has this huge, massive trail. And as I understand things, I haven't yet seen a good explanation for why that happens.
No, you know, because you would think that they would all behave in exactly the same manner.
Yeah, I mean, when you've got something that's within your field of view, you know, the atmospheric conditions do not, they don't act in like little cells, you know, a couple of miles wide. They're much bigger than that.
Yeah.
And a temperature variation or a humidity variation would only happen over a much wider scale. So any meteorologist that says to me, oh, well, it's all down to, you know, the actual, you know, the moisture level in that part of the air based on the one that's further away, I don't buy that. And I've actually seen myself... planes, you know, where you can see one plane leaving no trail flying over the top of a plane leaving a trail, which of course shouldn't really happen because the condensation is essentially caused by low temperature, and the higher you go in the atmosphere, the lower the temperature. So if you get a plane that's higher up, you know, not leaving a trail, over one that's lower down that is leaving a trail, that's actually the opposite of what you'd expect.
Yep.
Now, people have said, you know, there's temperature inversions and layers of moisture and all this. And frankly, because I'm not an expert meteorologist, I only know the basics, I don't know whether that's true or not. And you can't sort of test that in every situation. Now, I can't sort of say, well, that plane there's at that height, that plane's there at that height. I'll throw my thermometer up to, you know, 30,000 feet, sort of thing. You just can't do it.
Yeah.
So unless you can actually get all that data somehow from that exact situation, it's very, very difficult to get a clear picture of what's going on. One of the very unusual things that's been happening in the last couple of years is circular trails, and I've had people sending me pictures of these, and there was
I've taken one as well over Liverpool just a couple of weeks ago,
And there've been quite a few more in the last sort of 18 months, and a few people have sent me them, and I've collected some of these. And there was one in the Skegness area last year in January, and it left these multiple concentric circles of trails, and it was claimed to be a NATO aircraft that was doing this on an exercise, but I'm not sure I buy this. So we're then into it's some type of spray coming out of the back of these, which is not just the normal exhaust, you know, which is essentially water vapor and carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide.
Well, and if they did fly on water, we could expect to see the kind of condensation levels that they allegedly emit in, which obviously isn't the case either, is it?
No, well, I mean, you know, when you burn kerosene, when you burn hydrocarbons, you get primarily water and carbon dioxide from that process. But so people are now saying that they're having, you know, particles coming down, and they've got things like barium and aluminium compounds in the rainwater. Mm. I've seen bits and pieces about that, but I'm still, my jury is still a little bit out on that particular thing.
Mm.
Let us take the argument that we have indeed got some type of particles, you know, coming down or staying in the air, and it's been caused by suspended particles. We then have to ask the question, what exactly are those particles and how are they being delivered?
Yeah.
Now, there's two ways, really, that if these particles are coming out of the aeroplane, another word is aerosols, of course, aerosolized compounds. If they are coming out of the aircraft, there's two ways essentially that can be done. One is that something is being added to the fuel, the fuel is burning, and then the particles are coming out in the exhaust. And the other possible way is that we've got extra nozzles, you know, attached to the wings. And somehow you've got tanks in the aircraft that are full of
I've seen a lot of them with the trails coming out of the tail end of the plane. So that takes away exhaust because that goes...
Not necessarily, because some planes do have a third engine in the rear section. It depends on the type of plane. But yes, other people have said that they've seen, you know, a four-engine plane with five trails coming out of it. So, you know, yes, you know, again, we there's conflicting observations, you know, such as you've sort of alluded to.
Well, I mean, they are doing it under the guise of research, so I suppose they could also be researching delivery methods.
Well, there is no disclosed active research program which is delivering any type of spraying into the atmosphere. There is talk of it, but there is no official statement that this is going on a you know, daily or two or three times a weekly basis. You know, that's my understanding, and we've had letters from the Civil Aviation Authority and the Department of Transport, you know, and people have sent me these, and I've written my own letters to them, and they say there is no type of spraying going on. You know, the only type of thing you're likely to get any particulate spray from is crop spraying, which of course is, you know, maybe 100 foot off the ground or something, or 50 feet off the ground, whatever it is. According to official sources, there is no spraying going on. But going back to what we're seeing in these trails, we've got two possibilities. As I say, we've got the fuel, you know, having some additive to it, or we've got some separate system, you know, fitted to the plane, disguised possibly in some way, and tanks within the aircraft, you know, squirting the stuff out at whatever. And again, if you observe this, you know, you can watch some of the planes. They'll fly over, they'll start trailing, they'll stop, and then they'll start trailing, you know, within your field of view, and get various sort of patterns.
Yeah.
This again doesn't make a lot of sense with the standard, you know, oh, it's all just a condensation trail. And at certain times, you know, and I've seen this, and other people have seen this.
I've seen it too.
Yeah, they seem to be switched on and off according to some type of, you know, design or program or something. You don't know quite what, but that's what it appears to be. But nobody is giving any answers. And like a lot of these subjects, you know, the same is true here. We've got those that know don't talk, and those that talk don't know. It's the same story, and I can also show, you know, in the presentation that I've put together over the years, I know that there is disinformation being put out about these trails. They're actively putting out information which is untrue, and people who are presenting this information know that it's untrue.
That's in the BBC documentary that they did, isn't it? Or that little short film that they've done. I don't know if you're referring to that, but the BBC did actually create a short documentary to outline how these trails are being formed.
I don't think I've seen that. Do you know how recent it was?
Probably a couple of years, actually.
Right.
I'll find it for you. I'll post it on your page, because it is like just whatever. You know, it's like ridiculous.
Right. I mean, there is definitely something going on, but I'm still not sure what it is, because going back to the idea of the fuel additives, which a lot of people talk about, then that's a very difficult one, because as you're probably, you know, aware, at least to some extent, that these jet engines on these aircraft are very finely precision engineered pieces of equipment, and they have to run continuously and reliably almost 24/7. You know, they spend a little bit of time on the ground, you know, maybe for a couple of hours or something in normal operation, and they'll, you know, they'll check them and refuel them and scrub them a bit or whatever they do to them. And then they go back up in the air.
Yeah.
So if you've got any materials of any kind that are leaving any kind of sooty deposits or any metallic deposits are going to coat any part of that engine is going to, you know, not work. So this idea of adding stuff to the fuel, when you actually start to think about it carefully, as I've tried to outline, it doesn't quite stack up. But then again, this idea that we've got, you know, separate nozzle systems, you know, added to the aircraft. Well, even that's very strange, because I've actually got a video and photographs of an EasyJet flight, which I captured in 2010, almost 3 years ago now, actually, almost to the day, actually. And I've put an article about this on my website, because 3 years ago, I was getting a bit fed up of not knowing what was going on. So I got a little device called an AirNav radar box, which is an off-the-shelf device. Cost me about £400, so it wasn't cheap.
Yeah.
And I got it off eBay. And you can plug it into your USB port on your computer, you know, put the software on it, and it's got an aerial on it, and it will basically pick up what's called ADS-B, which is an aircraft signaling system, and it will display on your screen the aircraft within your, well, within range of the receiver, which in my case is about 130-mile radius. It will display all the aircraft that it can pick up, and it will tell you, for those that are broadcasting this ADS-B signal, it'll tell you how high they are, what their destination is, what where they took off from, and various other bits of information about the aircraft, such as the registration number, the type of aircraft, and the airline. So I started to log these flights, and one of which was an EasyJet flight, so I could prove it was an EasyJet flight.
Yeah.
And I had another aircraft in the sky at the same time, and this EasyJet flight was leaving a big, long, massive trail down to the horizon, and then I got another aircraft sort of in the same region of the sky, not leaving a trail.
Mm.
So I wrote to EasyJet and said, you know, basically, what the hell is going on? And they said, we cannot answer your operational query. So the airlines won't tell me what's going on. They wouldn't give me an explanation.
Well, you know that the airlines are totally involved, because I used to live on the flight path to Leeds and Bradford Airport, and that, right in front of my window, they would come in that direction all the time. And then if any of them were trailing, that's where they would change their course.
Right. Well, I mean, again, it's very difficult to pin this data down, because I live about 5 miles away from East Midlands Airport, and I do get a lot of flights coming over here, and I've tracked these with this box. And so, you know, I wrote to the airport and asked them, and they basically said to me, East Midlands Airport have no interest in any traffic unless it's below 15,000 feet, because their, you know, obviously their air traffic control system is only going to be concerned with aircraft that are coming into land at East Midlands Airport. So they're not really bothered about anything that's going above 15,000 feet, because that's going to sail over the top of them. They've got enough to do, you know,
yeah,
you know, managing all the aircraft at the lower altitude. So all of that air traffic that's coming to over you is probably going to, if it's related to what's at Leeds Bradford, it's going to be, you know, below 15,000 feet, and you won't see any trails from that. So all of those trails that you're seeing, in theory, should be from aircraft that are not, you know, not coming into to Leeds Bradford.
Yeah. Well, so, and another incident that I witnessed as well, which was really shocking to me, when I was in Leeds City Centre, I was stood in Millennium Square and I was waiting for somebody, and I was just looking at the sky because it was an absolute mess. And I saw these two planes that were coming over, so I started taking photographs of them, and they actually had a race. And they came up, the one that was behind it, which was quite a way behind it, it just came tanking up so fast over the top. I thought, if anyone was in that, if it was a passenger plane, everybody would be pinned to their seats and their eyeballs would be in the back of the skulls. It was fast. And it came right up to be so close to the other one that was originally in front of it, I could not even tell them apart in the photographs.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I thought, well, that breaks every single aviation law that ever was ever put into place. I'll give you these photographs. And it was over the city centre. I thought, what if there was an incident then?
Well, you do see incidents like this. I mean, I've seen one or two where the aircraft are quite close together. And there's a couple of interesting YouTube videos where the flights are, coming very, very close together. And you can see this from the pilot's perspective, you know. Mm. And I was told by a pilot, this chap, I've got a pilot who writes to me occasionally, and he says, though, you know, they go in very strict sort of air corridors, which, I mean, I don't know. It sounds very strange to me that they would be that close, because I'd heard previously that aircraft were supposed to stay 5 miles apart, you know,
yep.
to give them time to manoeuvre in the case of emergency. You know.
Well, that's what I believed as well, yeah.
So, you know, I can't remember where I got that figure from, but, you know... I
got it from the Prune forums, you know. The that's where I read that, yeah.
Right. So... You know, there's a whole lot of conflicting information, both in what you observe and what you're told.
Yeah.
So I'm still wondering what the hell is going on, because it's clear for several reasons that something really is going on. One of which is the unusual manoeuvres of these aircraft, which they're not the manoeuvres of civilian aircraft. I mean, you don't get EasyJet flights going in circles around
no.
you. But then again, what are all these military exercises that are going on? You know, that their terms. Why are they doing these circles? They just don't give us a reason. You know.
Yeah.
So you're left in the dark, and you can't. You know, that domain above 30,000 feet or whatever. It's not an accessible domain to us.
Mm-hmm.
We can't go up there and. You know, casually walk up there and sort of get a pair of binoculars and see if we've got people in the plane, you know, and stuff. I mean, I've heard people saying, well, look, some of these flights are just remotely piloted, you know, and because people have said, well, if they really are spraying something, well, who's doing it? Why would anybody want to fly a plane, you know, spraying toxic stuff into their own atmosphere that they've got to breathe when they land,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, it beggars belief, and it's beyond all reason, isn't it?
It is. So this idea of toxic spraying, to me, I'm only partly convinced about it. And although it looks like that, you know, you and I both know that a lot of this stuff that goes on is to make you think that things are a certain way by showing you things in a certain way. And actually, they're not like that. There's information that you're not being shown. And that's that, when you know that information, that's what will get you closer to the truth, or actually right on top of it.
Yeah.
So you know, that's the sort of position that I'm at with chemtrails. And one of the add-ons to that is what I think they're involved with in some way is geoengineering. In other words, they're something to do with the climate being modified. Right.
Yeah.
Whether it's a spraying program that's putting stuff into the atmosphere to modify the climate directly, I don't know. I still remain to be convinced of that. But what I am convinced about is that there is weather control going on, and it was done on 9/11. That I have no doubt about that, at the very, very least. And I think that whatever technology is being used, which I think could be based on the sort of stuff that Wilhelm Reich was working on in the 60s, which is to do with orgone energy and orgone accumulators and this sort of thing. I think it's something to do with that technology, some derivative of that. And what we might be seeing in the case of at least some of the trails is that if you've got an ordinary aircraft, you know, making its way through the atmosphere in a perfectly normal sense, if some energy system is being used to manipulate the atmosphere in some way externally, either from the ground or from space, I know not which it is.
Yeah.
Then one of the effects of that would be to modify the atmosphere, and also it could modify the way that condensation forms and dissipates from aircraft trails.
Mm.
And I think if you look at what happens and observe these trails, that the observations are somewhat consistent with that idea. If you think that the atmosphere is somehow being modified, and that's why we're seeing more trails. In other words, most of the trails are actually quite benign. There's no toxicity in them. They are just indeed the normal exhaust from a normal jet flight, but we are seeing them have these weird effects and wavy lines because there is some external effect being applied to the part of the atmosphere where they, you know, they happen.
Well, my studies kind of took me through a military route. It was totally unconnected. I was already kind of looking at different technologies when I had this massive awakening to what was going on with the chemtrails, because it was November 2010 and it was insane. And I saw it and I thought, there's no denying it now, you know. I forgot what I was going to say. The technology that I was looking at was to do with it's like a multi-layered radar system, and basically all that, you know, the high altitude nuclear explosions have sort of pumped up the Van Allen belts and created various other radiation belts, and these metals actually are attracted to the radiation in the air in these belts, and then what they do is they monitor them for electromagnetic pulse. So they could probably track drones, but also other foreign technology, whether it be, terrestrial technology or extraterrestrial technology, whatever. And if there's any space program going on that we don't know about, that they're coming in and out, they can monitor that. It's like a spider's web, and works on three different levels of the atmosphere, you know, the three different levels of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've kind of noticed as well, apart from the weapons applications, is these hazes and these rainbows and these bows that we're getting that are becoming upside down because of where the light is being deflected off these particles. It's creating the opposition effect because it's shining off basically what is a dome. So it's reflecting upwards from underneath. And it's like almost like they've created this low-level spraying to actually generate these conditions of like the greenhouse effect and global warming, etc., for money purposes. Because if you think about what the reasons of why they're saying they want to geoengineer, and what they want to do is to create this sunscreen to deflect everything up, but these particles don't have a particular way that, oh, well, we're going shiny side up. They are reflective all over. So, you know, the light is the kind of way that the light is reaching us is changing even because of this.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a few things there I can sort of pick up on. I mean, these are some of the ideas. If they are indeed spraying particulate matter, is it to block out the sun? You can look at these programs now, and you know, I've just been reinvestigating this. Solar radiation management is actually the term.
Yeah.
And there's
been
a lot of talk of this. You know, there's been articles published over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, and it's starting to enter the vocabulary of scientists that are looking at this supposed nonsense of CO2-based global warming, which, you know, they've had to actually, University of East Anglia have actually committed fraud to try and convince people that this is a real problem, and of course it's got absolutely nothing to do with the problem.
Well, no, because as obviously on your website, you have that great document about the entire solar system is actually heating up.
Well, that's what appears to be happening. You know, I mean, that was something that I heard from a few years ago from David Wilcock and Richard Hoagland, but I checked out some of the data myself, and you know, there's changes going on all over the solar system. So this idea that it's purely carbon dioxide, which is, I think, it's something like 0.03% of the atmosphere. It's a tiny fraction of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And you can see how they've propagandized it.
Yeah.
But that, like you say, that by putting out that propaganda and disinformation, and also dressing it up and building it up within the scientific community, and portraying it as if it's, you know, absolutely proven fact, when it's actually a fraud, completely a fraud, then they can get away with these statements, that we need to do this solar radiation management, which, you know, as some people have pointed out, and I think you were sort of tangentially alluding to, is that, you know, if you say, well, we've already tested these programs of putting stuff in the atmosphere, you know, with planes, and we found that it works, then people, if they believe this global warming scam, they're going to accept that's what needs to be done. And the people that are running the planet, or whoever they are, they can get away with their agenda of, whatever they want to do to the air. They can basically control the air that we breathe even more than they do now. You know, they can dictate what goes into the atmosphere. They can dictate what effect it has on our body. You know, for example, if they wanted to reduce the sunlight level, it will reduce our production of vitamin D.
Yeah.
You know, and all that side of things. They can say, oh, well, we need crops that will grow in, you know, less sunlight. So here's these genetically modified seeds. But going further than that, if they can actually engineer the weather across the board, you know, make it have wintry conditions in summer, have some summery conditions in winter, have drought when they want. Floods when we want, which I think is what we've been seeing over the last few years. And then they can say, oh, this is all because we're burning too much fossil fuel. So
exactly,
what you've got to do, everyone, is you've got to, we can't have cars anymore, you know, you've all got to get your public transport. And we can't even use that too much because we've got to ration it. So you need a card, you know, and you've got to get it stamped or whatever, and you've got credits and all this. And that's, you know, that's the sort of thing where...
But at the same time, they're making people afraid of public transport with all the diseases and all the blah, blah, blah. So it's like, they just want people, what do they want us to do? All work from home.
Yeah. I mean, it's the underlying, one of the main underlying things is to generate fear and paranoia.
Yeah.
Across the board, within the alternative research community and within mainstream. The tactics are the same. The implementation is just somewhat different. So... You know, that's the way I see it. And going back to the chemtrails thing generally for a minute, the other thing which, you know, somebody alerted me to a couple of years ago, probably longer now, that I had to make a page about because I thought it was very significant, was the subliminal chemtrails.
Oh, I wanted you to talk about that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so you're seeing these put into posters and adverts, and I mean, there's one guy made the film Don't Talk About the Weather, and he's got this... you know, he's just so observant to pick this out. It was a Specsavers advert from about 4 or 5 years ago, and you can see this sort of wispy contrail in the background, and I'd have to go and watch it again, but these spectacles are sort of dancing along this contrail, and you can see your eyes drawn to this, you know. And then the other big one which somebody alerted me to.
Well, I sent you that one with the Virgin advert.
That's it. It was you, wasn't it?
Because I'd heard you on the radio show saying that you were looking for evidence prior to 1986, and I saw that, and I was sent it straight to you and saying, well, this was made in 1970. So you checked it out on your DVD in your collection. Yeah.
And that's, you know, you've put your finger right on one of the main cases there of subliminals. They put it into that Virgin commercial, and the person that Phil Morris wrote to, because Phil Morris is another researcher who was onto this, you know, long before I was, and he sent me quite a lot of stuff, some of which is on my website. And he wrote to this company that made the commercial, and they said, oh, yes, we put it in deliberately, you know, because we wanted to make it look more modern, the sky to look more modern, which of course, didn't really make any sense, because they were trying to romanticise,
about the past.
Yeah, about the golden age of rail travel, and, you know, they wanted to sort of do a renaissance of that in the advert, you know.
It was Virgin trains, wasn't it? So it's obviously a Virgin aircraft as well.
Well, they didn't even put an aircraft on it. They just put the trail. You know, you'd at least think...
Oh, right.
Yeah, there was no aircraft there. Because if you'd at least think that if it was for Virgin, Virgin Atlantic or something, Virgin Airways, they would put an aircraft and somehow it sort of swooping down, or you'd zoom up and see the pilot waving or something on the side. But no, they didn't do that. They just put the trail, you know. So it just did not make any sense. To me, it didn't, except to say, yep, they're trying to acclimatise us to the trails. You know, and I walked into a bookshop around Christmas time. This was probably about 5 years ago, I was with my daughter, and we picked up this book. I've put the cover on my website, Good Night, Mr. Tom. It's a story of a wartime, an elderly man in wartime who has to look after an evacuated child. And that sounds bad, doesn't it? A child who's been evacuated from, you know, London or something. And he has to look after the child. And he doesn't like children, you know, and then he grows to like the child, you know, and everything. And the cover of this book had a chemtrail grid on it, you know. And it's just that it was obviously a reprint, you know, updated version that would be, because it was an old book from, I don't know, the 60s or 70s.
Oh my God, and they put it in the book. Jesus.
It's on the cover. It's right there on the cover. And you can also see it in the one of the main ones that was pointed out to me. I didn't find this. This was somebody sent this to me. I think it was on Rens's website or something. The Over the Hedge film, which is the CGI film for kids, I think about 2003 or 4 or something, 5 maybe.
Yeah.
And it's completely CGI. There is no live action. And yet they've got chemtrails in the sky and a few of the shots.
I've seen that. And in Cars, or one of them.
The Cars things, movie as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I watched Prometheus.
Right.
And there's a bit where I think there's somebody sat in the entrance to a cave and it's a shot from behind them. And there's like the clouds. And there's like these two sort of cumulus clouds, but there's a little gap in between, and in that gap there is a chemtrail cross in Prometheus. I was like, oh, you've got to be shitting me.
Yeah, I know. So they're definitely doing this, and particularly in the Over the Hedge movie, because, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, they just want to make it a natural-looking sky. Well, why not put a flipping cloud in there then?
Yeah.
No. Clouds are in the sky naturally, not flipping trails. That's not.
Well, look at all the Tom and Jerry cartoons, Roadrunner cartoons, Pink Panther cartoons. They've always got funky clouds in the sky. None of them are ever lines.
That's right.
I look for old paintings of the sky and things like that, and nothing in them either.
Well, exactly. You know, so
historically, in that sense, there's no evidence of them.
That's it. And when, you know, and people say, oh, well, you know, the classic one that comes up is these pictures of bombers in World War II, you know, and the engines were completely different and the configuration of them was different. So you can't really compare this set of trails from this picture. And there's only one or two pictures of them. So, you know, you get all these climatologists and they'll come out with all this sort of rubbish, you know, and they just believe their own rubbish all the time, you know, and you can't really get through that because you haven't got the pieces of paper.
There's also the threat of losing funding because all funding is peer review. So you only get funded if everybody likes what it is that you're going to say.
Yeah, yeah, that's
so
right.
So it's just like it's so hampered before we even start because...
I remember reading, you know, going back to this global warming scam, I remember reading something a few years ago, quite a few years ago now, and there was some scientist who was very sceptical of the whole thing, and he was basically, you know, he'd been in the sort of game long enough to see what happened. He said that if, for example, you were a biologist of some kind, and you wanted to, say, do a study of the squirrel population in Scotland or something, and you applied for funding for that, you'd probably get it declined. But if you applied for funding at this time, you know, the effect of global warming on the squirrel population, you'd get the funding, you know.
Oh my God.
Because it was a bit to do with global warming, you know, and that's how it was working, and I think it's still very much like that.
Well, I read some research into, trees, how this is affecting trees and what kind of trees cope with it best, and pine trees cope with it best. And so all our forests are now becoming pine forests because they actually absorb heavy metals. Now, they've done these tests on pine forests all over the world, on mountains, in valleys, all, you know, everywhere. And then basically, obviously, there's a higher incidence of heavy metals in the pine needles at lower levels. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the main ingredients for Tamiflu is pine needles. So they're actually keeping all of that, like the recycling it. It's like, oh, well, if they haven't breathed it in, we can feed it to them, you know. I just think that they know what they're doing. There's too many devious things like that, you know. When I discovered that strontium and calcium were right next to each other on the elemental table, so they behave very similarly in the body when they're being ingested, and the body can actually process it, but only to a point where, it, obviously, because it's a radiation, if you've got a lot of it in your body, then it can build up in it and cause various genetic malfunctions. Now, milk is full of strontium because it's all over the place from all of the high altitude nuclear explosions that they've done over the years, which is thousands. And the cows eat the grass is full of the strontium, and then it's in the milk. So they're kind of pushing it, you know, drink your milk, kids, it's calciumy, when they know for a fact that milk is full of strontium and it is going to have a negative health effect on the, on anybody, but especially kind of driving it into children and, you know, making it really kind of like the thing that you need to drink lots of milk to grow your bones and healthy, strong teeth and healthy bones, which is what strontium actually does. It does strengthen your teeth and your bones in the same way as calcium does, but it causes other problems. Mm. So I don't believe for a minute that they're not aware of all of these things and these health effects. They're just playing dumb, especially when you sort of link aluminium to Alzheimer's, and then aluminium in the brain and fluoride in the brain. When you drink fluoride, it goes to the brain and it helps the brain absorb aluminium, and aluminium is often found in the brains of Alzheimer's sufferers. So, you know, there's a definite link.
I think there is some kind of link, but I think also you've got to be aware that this isn't overplayed, because I've, you know, for example, I've seen several studies claiming, or several articles claiming, that there's barium and strontium and aluminium being sprayed in the atmosphere. But when you actually try and track down the evidence for that, I mean, I don't dispute what you're saying about the, you know, the way that it can get into the body and what it can do in the body. Then I haven't been convinced by the evidence that I've found. And a couple of people have said, you know, they're going to send me rainwater tests. Mm. With, you know, showing elevated levels of barium and aluminium, but I've never really seen those. The only ones that I've seen have come from the States, and the particular one that comes to mind is the one that Rosalind Peterson talked about a few years ago. In she was in California somewhere, and she said that she'd seen barium and aluminium levels go up in the water there. Which, you know, there was no real explanation for. But again, we're back to this idea of, well, how are they delivering these particulates? And, you know, who's actually doing the spraying and this sort of thing? And I mean, to be honest, going back to the chemtrails issue, that there are probably much easier ways to deliver these toxins to us than spraying them out of the back of an aircraft. I mean, that's actually quite a difficult way to do it. It's easy to just go and dump them in a reservoir or something, you know, or whatever.
Well, I've never believed for a minute that it's eugenics. I mean, I know that pharma just want us all to be ill because they want us all to be on drugs, and then they make loads of money. So they don't want us dead because we're worthless dead. But if we're ill, then, you know, if we're on drugs, then we're worth money, aren't we? So, you know, I think, I'm convinced that it's as dark as that, you know, that they do know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that they're trying to kill us all, because if they wanted to do that, they'd just put something deadly in it and we'd all be dead, wouldn't we?
Well, this is it, you know. I mean, but I think one of the primary things is getting the fear into people. And they can do that just as well, if not better, in the alternative knowledge or conspiracy community, or whatever you want to call it, as with the mainstream.
Well, we do the dirty work for them, don't we?
Well, if you're not careful, you can end up doing that. You know, and that's happened to me with the 9/11 research a few years ago. You know, I ended up doing some dirty work for them, which you know, I wasn't too happy about when I found out what I'd done, you know, without really realising it.
Yeah.
So you know.
Oh, what was that? Do you want to talk about it?
Well, it was, I mean, I've talked about this before. It was to do with this, the thermite fraud, basically. I got roped into that by Stephen E. Jones, the physicist, and ended up making a video clip for him to help him supposedly prove his thermite theory. And, of course, it's just nonsense. It's just another scam.
Well, there was no thermite, because that was one of the things that I was going to...
No, I mean, and it becomes very clear once you study the evidence, but I mean, it took me probably 6 or 7 months at least to realise that that's, you know, that's what had been done. You know, that they'd set up this scam, roped me into it, you know, they'd sort of roped me into it, and I realised that I'd been used to put out disinformation to the thermite stuff because I trusted this guy, Joe.
Yeah.
But then it later became clear that he's connected to the Department of Energy. He was involved in covering up cold fusion, which is an energy phenomenon which could have given us a route to free energy in the late 80s. He did work for Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where they developed the atomic bomb. Right in the heart of the military industrial complex, of course. And this is a guy who crops up in the 9/11 truth movement just after the technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center come out in 2005. So, and people are still pushing this guy out. In fact, this Tony Rook case, which happened last week, I think it was, with the BBC, with not paying his license fee. I don't know if you...
Oh, yeah, that was great.
What do they have outside the courtroom? They have a big banner with thermite written on it, and 9/11 was an inside job. And they had Niels Harriet there, who also pushes this thermite story.
Right.
And he was
because I still thought that, I thought that that was sort of standard evidence, and I still
well,
thought
they claimed
that
it is. They claim that it is, but if you study this, you see more. It's a bit like studying the chemtrails very carefully. You see, it doesn't stack up, and there are a number of reasons for that. Not only because of the physical effects. I mean, let's just take a few basic things and I'll ask you a couple of questions. Do you know what thermite actually is? Do you know what it is?
Well, I know that it's a material that can pretty much burn through anything. I've seen experiments on TV where, I don't know, I think it was like Mythbusters, they tried to destroy a car with it. So
that's kind of correct. But, there was Mythbusters, I think, and there was also Brainiac was one of them.
Right, I think I've seen that as well.
And so what does it look like when you saw this thing? Just describe what you saw.
I think it was in packages. I'm not sure.
What did you see happening when they set...
Oh, it was like brilliant white light, like all the sort of sparks and melting stuff.
So did you see that in the destruction of the World Trade Center?
No.
So that's the first observation, that you can see that if you have a small amount like that was used in that experiment, maybe, I don't know, a couple of pounds of maximum, that's just for maybe, a small model that they used or an engine block on a car that they burnt through, I think, on the particular demonstration that I watched. Scale that engine block up to the size of the World Trade Center, all right?
Yeah.
Scale one engine block up to 236 steel columns, which are 1,300 feet high.
Yeah.
I mean, Niels Harriet claims that there were thousands of tons of thermite, right? So that's the first thing. Purely on a simple observational level, you can go and look at those videos and so on. You can look at all that stuff and you can see it cannot possibly have played any significant role in doing any destruction to the World Trade Center for two reasons. One is the visible, display of pyrotechnics that was not seen. Yeah. Also, the intense heat, which, as you said, it can just about burn through anything. Well, actually, it burns at around 2,000 degrees centigrade. I'd have to check that. It might be 1,500 degrees centigrade.
It's quite hot.
But we had people coming out of the World Trade Center covered in dust. And they were not burned. They described that the dust around them was cooler than the air that they were originally in.
Mm.
So it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Do you know why they said it was thermite? Do you know what from a chemistry point of view why they came up with that idea? I think I know why they did.
I can't remember now. No.
I can tell you why they came up with it, or why I think they came up with it. You don't know actually what thermite is, so I will tell you it's actually could be a number of things, but primarily it's aluminium oxide and aluminium powder and iron oxide. Okay, that is the most common version of thermite, but it can actually be I think you can even have copper oxide and aluminium powder. Aluminium is a more reactive metal than iron. So when you break through the oxide coating of aluminium, which forms on it because of its nature, it will start to react very violently and it will reduce the iron oxide, talking in chemistry terms. It will steal the oxide and it will form aluminium oxide and molten iron. That's what thermite produces.
Right.
So basically, to go back, thermite is a combination of aluminium powder and iron oxide, right? So if they're claiming that they found thermite residues in the destruction of the World Trade Center, what they're claiming is they found a mixture of aluminium powder and iron oxide. So what was the World Trade Center made of?
Well, it's going to have been made of iron for the supports, lots of concrete, probably lots of aluminium, lots of probably copper as well with the...
Maybe some copper in the pipe.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we just take the exterior, which was actually an aluminium alloy, I mean, you can look that up. I don't think it was pure aluminium, but it was you know, a large percent of aluminium metal was in that exterior. So there's your aluminium. And then, of course, you had all the steel girders, not quite the same as iron, but as you know, if a steel girder is stood within a building for 30 years, as was with the World Trade Center, you will form a coating of rust, a coating of iron oxide.
Yeah.
So all that they're claiming is that they found iron oxide and aluminium powder in the dust of the World Trade Center, which is exactly what you would expect to find.
Yeah.
The buildings have been turned to dust, which is what happened to them.
Yeah.
And thermite never did, never will, never has turned a building to dust. All it has ever done is burn things, and they use it to destroy paper quickly in the military because it burns very hot and very quickly. So they use it to destroy documents with what's called a thermite grenade, and they use it to weld pieces of rail together. They do not use it to demolish buildings, despite what you will have read on 9/11 Truth websites, despite what I used to think about that. So that basically rules out thermite almost completely. But the second thing which rules out thermite is really more circumstantial. And that's the fact that comes from what Dr. Judy Wood did in 2007 when she knew that NIST, I'll explain what NIST is. NIST is the National Institute for Standards and Technology. They produced 10,000 pages of technical reports at a cost of, I think, $16 million following a mandate from the US Congress. They produced this set of reports to explain, supposedly, the destruction of the World Trade Center. 10,000 pages. And Dr. Judy Wood, who had similar expertise to some of the people who wrote some parts of those reports, you know, she'd studied the evidence herself and knew that what was in those reports was a fraud, was fraudulent. So under US law, she decided to send a request for correction to NIST, which means that if you find that a report is either fraudulent or incorrect, under US law, you can ask for that report to be corrected and reissued, and if it's not corrected and reissued, you can sue the people that wrote the reports. And in the case of the NIST technical reports, NIST didn't actually write them, but they gave money to companies with technical expertise to produce these reports. And actually 23 different companies were employed to write different parts of these 10,000 pages of reports. And so basically what Dr. Judy Wood did was, through an attorney, Jerry Liebhardt, she sued the contractors for fraud because she submitted a request for correction. They denied that request. They refused to reissue the reports and correct the errors. And so she sued the companies that had done the reports for the fraud that they committed. And within her legal evidence that she submitted and within the request for correction, she laid out the summary of the case, which shows that energy effects were seen in the evidence which destroyed the towers. We had things turning to dust in the absence of heat. We had unusual effects with things being levitated. We had no seismic signature, very low seismic signature in proportion to the size of the buildings. Mm. There was almost no noise. There were no explosions. There was no sound of the building falling down. The bathtub survived. In other words, the huge amount of girders that should have fallen did not destroy the concrete slurry wall, and it didn't leak, which would have let in the Hudson River. That didn't happen either. So she put all this evidence into her document, and she said that there was some form of directed energy weapons was involved in the destruction of the towers. That was in 2007. So that all went into her legal challenge. And you can read that all on her website if you wanted to do that. Or you can even go onto NIST's website and find it there, because they have to put it on their website. So it is all there if you go and hunt for it.
Yeah, I'll have a look at that.
They moved it around a couple of years ago, so it's not that some of the original links probably don't work, but it's still there, I think, last time I looked. So basically, Dr. Judy Ward talked about energy weapons on her website, in the talk she'd given, and she also put it into her legal challenge. Let's go back to the thermite story. So we had Steve Jones from 2005 talking about thermite, and then we had the architects and engineers from 9/11 Truth talking about thermite, all these people talking about thermite. A group of these people, James Gourley, who was an attorney, Steve Nee Jones, Richard Gage, Niels Harrett, Kevin Ryan, who have all some level of technical qualifications in subjects to do with either physics or engineering or architecture. They also submitted a request for correction to NIST 3 weeks after Judy Wood did, coincidentally.
Right.
Weeks after. And you can go and read their request for correction if you want. And you can read the supplement which they submitted a little bit later. And in the original request for correction, you'll not see the word thermite mentioned anywhere in that document. You will see a URL link to Stephen E. Jones's paper about thermite, but there is no discussion of that research, and the word thermite is not mentioned at all. Neither is molten metal. So if they were so convinced and had been speaking for over a year to public audiences that thermite was the causative agent or one of the causative agents in the destruction of the World Trade Center, and they had evidence which proved this, according to them, why would they not want to put that into a legal challenge to NIST? My answer to that is they knew that they were committing fraud, because you cannot submit fraudulent evidence in a challenge to another fraud. That in itself...
yeah.
I documented that in probably 2009, I think, when I sort of really discovered what was in their document, or what wasn't in it, I should say.
Yeah.
When I made a little, because I made a little YouTube video where I sort of scroll through all the documents and do word searches and stuff, just to illustrate to people that really is, yes, that really is true, and I'm not just making it up just to be nasty to Stephen E. Jones or Richard, whatever.
Yeah.
You could actually go and check all that stuff that I've just told you for yourself if you spend the time and do your due diligence. You'll see that everything I've just told you is 100% true.
Yeah. And makes sense as well. Not just that, the amount of thermite that it'd need, it does seem just like an insurmountable task.
Right, and how would they start it, and how would they ignite it?
Yeah.
Sorts of questions. And, all these stories came out about bombs in the building, and then people have claimed that, Judy Wood doesn't explain the bombs in the building. Well, actually, if you read the book or watch the videos or look at the website, you'll find that the explosions were not bombs in the building, and we do have an explanation for them, and that's to do, again, with the energy effects which were happening within the building. We don't deny that there were witnesses did hear explosive sounds, and I think we've got one or two which were actually recorded.
Yeah.
But, of course, as you and I both know, everything that explodes is not a bomb. A paper bag, you blow up a paper bag, bang it with your hand, bang, that's not a bomb. It's just made an explosive sound, a sound of an explosion or a sound of a bang. Put an egg in a microwave oven, put it on for 2 or 3 minutes, and it'll go bang.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff falling, wasn't there? There's like the cars, there's all sorts. I mean, if something heavy lands on a car, it's going to make quite a loud bang. I know it's not going to do the thud thing, but the bangs that were heard, I couldn't have said that they were from an explosion, but your mind's directed to that by the narrative in the videos.
It is to some extent, and when you hear the word explosion, you then jump to a bomb, which is what William Rodriguez did. And I mean, William Rodriguez told this tale of, being in the basement of the World Trade Center when the supposed plane hit, and it wasn't a plane. He claims that his feet were lifted off the floor by the force of this explosion, which was in the basement. And I saw William Rodriguez in 2005 in London with the Jimmy Walter tour, and And I thought, wow, you know, this guy's got a pretty amazing story. But less than 2 years later, when he stayed in my house, I really began to realize that this guy was not telling the truth. And I'm not sure how much his story, I'll say, was not telling the whole truth, put it that way. His story, parts of his story might be true. I don't know. But, you know, when he's going on to Simon Mayo's radio program, and Simon Mayo is saying that he's just talking about a conspiracy theory, and then William Rodriguez says, oh, yeah, there's a lot of conspiracy theories, and most of them have been put out by Morgan Reynolds and Judy Wood. You know, and those are the only two people that he names in this Simon Mayo broadcast that's going out to a million people.
Yeah.
Then you can see, and it's not just that, but you can see that this guy's got an agenda, and that agenda is not consistent with giving people the whole story about what happened to the World Trade Center. You know, and I could go into that in a little bit more detail, but William Rodriguez is, in my opinion, a plant. He did a very good job of diverting people away and sort of encouraging. He never actually said there were bombs in the building. If you listen to this story carefully, I don't think he ever says, "Oh, I saw them planting bombs." But he makes little he makes little statements and little sort of
insinuations.
That's what I was looking for. That there were bombs, but he never actually says it. Because you know, ultimately he could be caught out, and I was caught up in that. You know, I organised two talks for him, but by the end of those two talks, I realised he was. I don't know how much of his story is true. I have a feeling that what he's doing is he's actually telling a partly true story, but it's not his story. It's somebody else's. Somebody else was doing what he did, and he picked up on their story. And again, I've got another reason for saying that. Which is to do with another witness called Kenny Johanneman, who actually, if you do a YouTube search for Kenny Johanneman, who was in the building, he tells a very similar story to part of Rodriguez's story, that he lifted somebody out of the building who had their skin hanging off, and helped them out into the ambulance, and that was a very similar story to the one that Red Rodriguez told.
Right.
Now, it could have been the same guy. In other words, you could say that this Rodriguez helped this guy and then passed him over to this other guy, Kenny Johanneman, you know, when he was coming out, sort of thing, or something. But it was very peculiar. And then, of course, Kenny Johanneman turns up dead a few years later, and he was one of the guys that was saying there was no plane that hit the building.
We'll touch on that in a minute, because I've got to do the jingle thing.
All right.
I'll be back with you in... What, about 2 minutes?
Okay, I'm going to get a drink for one of them.
Okay, yeah, you go for it. Actually, what I'll do is I'll put Gareth Ike's Remember Who You Are on, because I really like that, and then we'll put a little jingle on after. Back in a bit.
Chemtrails, child, animal and planet abuse. Geoengineering. Alternative energy. Disclosure. Prison planet. Agenda 21. Drones, biometrics. This is CMR, Critical Mass Radio, leading the way to stopping the control with proactive hosts, shows and solutions, and informative groundbreaking guests. Critical Mass Radio, the People's Station. Now, it's our turn.
Oh, I like that one. That's pretty dramatic. Right, Andrew, are you with us?
I am.
Right, where were we?
Well, we were talking about William Rodriguez.
And the chap who died.
And William Rodriguez and Kenny Johanneman. But, I don't know where you want to go from there.
I wanted to go towards this theory of Judy Woods.
Oh, it's not a theory, but yes, carry on.
Okay, all right. What Judy was saying actually happened. I really don't know that much about it.
And
what the technology could be, have we got it, what is it, how does it work, what happened to the buildings, you know, all of that sort of
right, stuff. Well, probably your best bet, I mean, I'll give an outline as best I can now, and it shouldn't take too long, but for those that are listening, if you look at the presentations, where did the towers go? There's actually one recently been posted from the conference that we went to in Holland in November, and they've done a fairly good job. There's a couple of slightly awkward edits that moments they could have edited out, just where there was a laser pointer lost and stuff like that. But apart from that it's called Where Did the Towers Go? And if you put that in and put it into your video search, or do BEM, Breakthrough Energy Movement, you should get the video up somewhere. And it's linked on my website as well, checktheevidence.com. And that will give you all the lowdown, really. But basically, the starting point for looking into this area really is to re-examine what happened to the buildings with your own eyes. And you will observe, if you watch the videos, that most of the buildings turned to dust.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't burn up, as Dr. Wood says. They didn't slam to the ground. And they didn't. They actually turned to dust in midair. That's what happened. They actually turned to dust in midair.
You know what? That is right, because they just do. It's like powder falling. It's
right.
Like,
right. Yeah. And that is proved not just by observation, but also by, for example, like I mentioned a couple of things in very quickly earlier on. You know what she did was she looked at the seismic data, and she compared the seismic data from the events on 9/11 to earlier events, like there was a small earthquake which was detected in the New York area, you know, and that actually had a bigger seismic signature, I think, or a comparable seismic signature to the World Trade Center coming down. But this earthquake was like, you know, thousands of miles away or something. I can't remember the exact details. Or it might have been a quarry blast that they did, which was, you know, way off, away from New York. But that had a similar seismic signature to the World Trade Center coming down, sort of thing, you know. And or in fact, it didn't come down. So the seismic signature is one thing. There was very, very little seismic signature, way out of proportion for what the size of the building was.
Mm.
So you saw the steel turning to dust, no seismic signature, no appreciable seismic signature. And then she also compares this to a controlled demolition of what's called the Seattle King Dome, which happened, I think, in year 2000. And there were seismic readings taken for that in quite some detail, so that's a good source to compare it to.
Mm.
And then you look at, for example, this thing I mentioned called the bathtub. Now, the World Trade Center, as you perhaps may have picked up from reading, went 9 stories underground, about 70 feet underground, I think it was. And that was essentially roughly 9 stories below sea level. Because, you know, the bottom of the World Trade Center is more or less, you know, you can walk out right up to the edge of the, you know, the port, as it were, and you're at sea level. So the bottom of the World Trade Center was at sea level. Therefore, the bottom stories were below sea level. So you had to construct this thing called the slurry wall or the bathtub for the World Trade Center towers to sit in before they sat on the bedrock, you know, underneath that. And this, there was some concern following the destruction of the towers, that when they had this earth moving equipment brought in, they were, you know, the spades and that were going to crash into the wall and fracture it, and then the river was going to come and rush in. Well, hang on a minute. If you've got earth moving equipment bumping into the wall and you're worried about that, why weren't you worried about these 500,000 tons of buildings crashing down into the bathtub?
Mm.
So that's another piece of evidence which shows that the buildings didn't actually hit the ground in solid form, or most of them didn't. Obviously, there was some building on the ground. You can clearly see that.
Yeah.
Similarly, if you go underground, we've got pictures from the underground, and there were actually shops, you know, stores underneath in these lower levels, and there were goods were taken out of these shops and put into a storage area away from the World Trade Center. So how is that possible? And we have these, what are called the PATH trains, like, you know, our underground in London or wherever, or the Metro in Newcastle. The underground trains, they ran under the World Trade Center, yet we had carriages recovered from these underground trains, and they had a few little dents on them. How is that possible? And we had 14 people survived in what's called Stairwell B, and they actually described coming down the stairs, they described the building coming apart around them. And then the next thing, they're looking up and they see sunlight coming through. So
Well, that's not possible, is it? If a building's falling down.
No, it's not possible. So if you say it was thermite, just, I know we've done that, but say you did, then, okay, so what happened, right? Say it was thermite, right? So the thermite was set off, it cut through the girders, and the girders all fell down. Did they? So you'd have a massive, huge pile of girders, and you'd have these people crushed. Didn't happen. Some people are saying it was nuclear devices that destroyed the buildings. Well, there were no loud explosions. There were no bright flashes.
No, that's not possible.
And again, if the nukes had been used to cut the building into chunks, or if it had burned, you know, if the kerosene story was correct and it had just burned and bent, you know, bits had bent and broken and fallen down, the building would have fallen down.
And then there would have been radiation, traces of radiation.
Yes, if it had been nukes. Mm. None of those things were seen. So the only explanation that fits all the observed data, in short, and I've gone through that very quickly, is the buildings turned to dust in midair. That is exactly what happened. And once you look at the data and you look at the attacks on the internet, on Dr. Wood, and to a lesser extent me, it's inescapable. That is what happened. If you go into it with an open and honest, you know, view of the data, that is what happened. So you then, once you confront that observation, that set of observations and that conclusion, you need to explain it.
Yeah.
And as I've said to people in the past, we know that there were 236 exterior columns of the building, and there were 47 interior steel columns, huge steel columns, each a quarter of a mile in, you know, high when they were all joined together, obviously in sections, but they were joined together into a quarter of a mile high.
Yeah.
These were gone in between eight and ten seconds, two of them. So how was that done? Well, the only thing that I know that can turn steel to dust, which is what it was turned to, is a file. In other words, you get a file in a metal workshop and you scrape the end of the steel and bits of dust will come off. So explosions don't turn steel to dust. They break it into chunks. Thermite melts it, turns it into blobs. The blob of whatever was melted would be at the bottom. It wouldn't just, you know, float off into the air because it'd be too heavy. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, so we're looking at something that can turn metal into dust. In very, very quickly. Also with no heat, with relatively little heat. That's the other great problem for all these other people that have tried to attack this so-called theory. In other words, we haven't discussed the theory at all. We've discussed what actually happened, that the building turned to dust, and you can clearly see that.
Yeah.
So you then, as Dr. Wood did, you look at some of the other effects that you see, steel turned to dust. We've seen the effects on these cars that she's dubbed toasted cars. And you can see that some of these were a quarter of a mile from the World Trade Center, and they appeared to be burned. Yet in some of the cars, the upholstery was undamaged. So how can you have a burnt car with upholstery that's undamaged? You can't. How can you have a car where the engine block is missing, but parts of the rest of the car are relatively undamaged? And then how can you get one car the right way up next to another car that's upside down? And how can you get David Hansher, who's a New York Daily News photographer, his account, we don't have a video of him being levitated, but he said he became airborne, he was running away from the collapsing building, or the turning to dust building, I should say, and he became airborne, and he was carried in the air for about a block. And some of these people in Stairwell B kind of reported sort of floating around as well as the building was coming down. So we've got several accounts of people being levitated. So that's something that needs to be explained. We've got spontaneous fires happening. We have a lady called Patricia Ondrovich, and her account, which was published on the New York Times website in 2002, she describes walking down the street and her coat catches on fire.
I remember reading that, yeah.
Yet she's not burned. And then we have the firemen. You know, these firemen are walking along. And they hear these oxygen tanks, which are on the back of their fire trucks, exploding spontaneously. So these trucks are parked away from the World Trade Center, but the oxygen tanks on them are exploding. And some of the fire trucks are exploding too. So how can that be? Is that a nuke planted in the fire truck? Is it thermite planted in the fire truck? No, of course it isn't. It's something different. And we see different effects, like some of the aluminium cladding, for example, which was the on the exterior, that survived, was not turned to dust, whereas the most of the central columns, about 80 or 90%, were turned to dust. So it had selective effects on materials, and some the paper, a lot of the paper survived. So again, you can look in these dust that's on the street, and you see pieces of paper within it. How can that be if this was burned down or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
It cannot be. So we've got the sort of weird catalogue of effects, and it appears to be to do with some type of energy. And eventually, what Dr. Wood kind of discovered in 2007, in late 2007, I discussed this with her at the time because I was somewhat familiar with it, was something called the Hutchinson effect, which again some people will claim that it's a fraud, it's a fake, it can't be reproduced, you know, go on Wikipedia. You still there? I think you've gone off, or have I gone off? Okay, I think
we're... Hey! Back. I don't know. I think I might
be old. My connection dropped out. No, it was this end. My router just suddenly went...
Oh, did it?
Don't want to know you, so...
Right, so, yeah, we were talking about what...
Yeah, so basically, you know, you go through these effects, and I got onto what was the Hutchinson effect. Mm. And this, you know, this I'd heard of the Hutchinson effect in 1999, so I already knew about this. And it's called the Hutchinson effect, but it's actually a combination of things.
Yeah.
And basically, how it came about was a Canadian experimental researcher called John Hutchinson. You know, he's one of these guys who's got like an intuitive understanding of what he's doing with various experiments in physics, really, in electronics.
Yeah.
He hasn't had a sort of formal schooling, so he just tries things out and he feels his way through things. And he was reproducing some of Nikola Tesla's experiments with these high voltage coils, magnetic fields. And he, you know, collected this equipment over sort of 7 or 8 years, sort of thing. It wasn't just something he came up with on a Saturday afternoon, sort of thing. Years' work, you know.
Wasn't he investigated by the Pentagon? His work investigated by them, and they said that he had to be part of the.
That is true, and that this is where it all connects in, which I'll hopefully I'll get time to get to. But he produced these effects in the late 70s, early 80s, where he could bend metal, he could turn it to jelly, he could have things flying up in the air, and he also produced things with weird fires, sort of burning effects and weird sort of effects similar to that. And he, you know, some of these were filmed at the time, but in the early 80s, he wasn't able to fully reproduce these things because it was very difficult to set up the equipment, you know, one way and then set it up the same way again. It was very much a sort of trial and error process.
Yeah.
But as you say, he was visited in 1983 by Colonel John Alexander, who was at that time acting as some kind of consultant for Los Alamos National Laboratories, which were back again, same old place. And he worked with a small team, I think, of 4 or 5 people, with John Hutchinson looking at his experiments. He worked with him for about 4 months, and he wrote some reports. And John Hutchinson never actually got a copy of this report, but I've got audios of John Alexander. He doesn't try and hide knowledge that he went and visited John Hutchinson. It's common, you know, it's common knowledge now.
Yeah.
So as you say, and then he was later offered money by the Pentagon to do some technology developments with his work, but he kind of, I don't know what he ended up doing with that. I think he never quite got off the ground because John didn't really want to get involved with any sort of organized projects. He just really wanted to do his own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so he never really seriously got involved with it to any extent that I've been able to establish. But it would appear from what Alexander said to John Hutchinson, that Alexander, when he went to see John Hutchinson, already knew the sorts of things that were going to happen when John switched on his equipment. It seemed he already knew that, according to what John told us.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
Well, there you go. So basically, John was able to bend metals, but with using no heat. He used the maximum amount of energy he used was about 1,500 watts, which is about half what is used to boil your kettle.
Mm.
And he used microwave beams. He used radar equipment, and he was mixing them together with fields from a Tesla coil and this sort of thing, which created what's called a static field. And he was seeing these effects, and they're fairly well documented. As I say, a number of people have videoed them, different companies. Some of the videos are better quality than others. John's videoed them himself.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of his videos, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you get people claiming, well, look, actually, what I can do is I can make a video, and when I play this video, it looks exactly the same as what John Hutchinson's doing, but I've done it using magnets or turning things upside down, and they'll therefore declare that it's a fake. Well, I've got something to say to those sorts of people. Well, what I can do is, as a Hollywood producer, I can fake a car crash, and I can get these people to fall out of the car with blood all over them. And it looks exactly the same as a real car crash. You know, you can barely distinguish it. So that means that the car crash that you just had last week must have been fake, you know.
Yeah.
So do you see my point? Just because you can make something, you can make a video that looks the same as the real thing, but it's actually you faked it, doesn't mean to say that disproves the real phenomenon. It might.
Yeah.
In certain cases.
All it proves is that you can fake it.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is a common mistake that people make, and people fall into this trap. Oh, well, that's been proved a fake because this video says so. Because in that particular case, what John Hutchinson does is so unbelievable. You know, people say, well, how can he possibly have discovered these effects? Well, by careful experimentation over years and years and years. That's how, you know.
Obsession.
Well, call it that if you want, John. You listen to John, he just says he's having fun, and I think what he is doing.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the fact is, if you study the effects that John has created with his experiments, there is a precise alignment with the evidence that Dr. Wood had catalogued from the World Trade Center. So what are we talking about? We're talking about mixing together different forms of energy, magnetic fields, electrostatic fields.
Yeah.
Microwave energy seems to be involved.
Yeah.
And then we have, for example, these horrific stories of these people that were sort of stayed in the building and were trapped in the building, and they couldn't get down the stairs for whatever reason, they were jumping out. Yet they weren't in any immediate danger. They could have, you know, been rescued or whatever, but they were jumping out. And again, looking at other evidence, it appears that the buildings didn't immediately turn to dust. The buildings underwent some kind of process for about 50 minutes or an hour. And I think Dr. Wood, I'm not sure whether she writes this directly in her book, but she certainly implies that this process involved microwave energy. And if you think of putting a person in a microwave oven and switching on the power, you would want to get out of there pretty quickly. And you don't even think about it as much as when you put your hand accidentally on a hot stove or whatever. And so that appears to be, you know, very quick summary, why these people were jumping out. So what about the electrical energy? Well, the other thing which all the thermite sniffers and people that are members of the Church of Thermatology, as we call it sometimes, what about Hurricane Erin? People don't know about this. Some people have never heard of this. Hurricane Erin was... it was hurricane season, of course, on September 11, 2001. Hurricane Erin formed and was given a name on the 1st of September 2001. It travelled across the Atlantic and it did a bit of damage in Bermuda on the 7th of September, and then travelled in a pretty damn straight line directly towards New York City. And it was off the coast of New York City, 500 miles off the coast. You couldn't really see it from New York City. You could certainly see it from space. And it actually slowed down. When it got there, it got there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was closer to New York City at 8 o'clock in the morning, slowed down, reached its widest expanse And then the next day, it kind of made a right-hand turn and went off out towards Newfoundland. How peculiar is that?
That is pretty interesting. Because I have heard about hurricanes being controlled by, you know, kind of microwave beams. And let's face it, I'm under no illusion that there's nothing up in space. I've read documents about laser beam technology that they've got, that they're kind of wanting to hurry up and get into space. Well, this is not what they said, but this is what I've read, you know, gleaned from the document, is because there are no laws applied to these weapons yet, that because the full extent of them isn't even understood. So they want to get them up there before any of these laws can be kind of, you know, before its applications can be fully understood, for any laws to be applied to it, and that all takes time, and they want to hurry, hurry, hurry. So I reckon they've just done it anyway.
Oh, of course. I mean, what you're looking at is a completely separate group of people that have completely classified technology, and there is absolutely no documentation about this anywhere that's available to people like us.
Bigelow is the only man who is allowed in the whole world to take weapons into space.
Well, I don't know about that. That's going off. That may or may not be true.
It is true. But what I'm saying is, if there's ever, and he's got like a kind of space station up there. The loophole is after changing the laws of the Sea Treaty and coming out of the Space Treaty along USA and Russia together, you know, they've kind of pulled out of that. We don't, you know, we're not weaponizing space.
Well,
so
again,
there's a full loop there that actually makes it possible for this weapon.
I certainly don't know the details of that. If you know, if you've got documents which show that, then obviously,
yeah,
you know, I guess there's something going on. Mm. But whether that's connected to,
it just explains how it would get up there. That's
well, I don't know. I tend to think it's just completely separate. We've got a secret space program, for example.
Mm.
You know, if you look at the evidence for that over time, you begin to realise that, you know, some of the anti-gravity technology developments went underground in the 50s.
Absolutely. I'm a big Paul LaViolette fan, so,
Right, but like Paul LaViolette, he won't talk about what happened on 9/11. Yet
I have heard him say he supports Judy Wood.
Well, he has it to some extent, but for example, he won't talk about weather modification technology, he won't talk about Hurricane Erin, neither will Tom Bearden. So we have a number of people, three of which we've named there, Paul LaViolette, Tom Bearden, Richard Hoagland. They've all talked about weather modification, but they will not talk about Hurricane Erin and 9/11, despite the very clear evidence that, to me at least, that this thing actually was somehow put into position. Now, I'd say we don't. Judy Wood doesn't say that she knows what this technology is.
Mm.
And for example, John Lear has stated, you know, he again has read Judy Wood's book, and he's spoken about it several times on Coast to Coast, and it's caused a spike in sales and all kinds of things. But John Lear claims, for example, that there are space platforms, and he's people have told him that these weapon, you know, beam weapon systems are up in space and firing stuff down on us. But that might be true, you know, but I don't think he's got any photographs on his website. He hasn't got any radio signal readouts, or he hasn't got any hard data which would prove that is true.
Yeah.
That's the point. So all I'm saying is people will make these claims, and they may very well be true. But in the case of what Dr. Wood has put into her book, she just presents magnetometer charts, seismic charts, temperature and weather readings from 9/11, the weather reports from the three New York airports, for example, that are in her book, that they had dry thunder at all three airports on 9/11, which means that they were, the influence of the storm system, the electrical influence, reached to those airports because there was electrical activity there, albeit, you know, on a small scale. But that meant that the field, the electrical field from the hurricane, reached as far as New York City. So we've already got levitation effects, we've got metal effects, we've got the electrostatic field from the storm system, and we've potentially got something which appears to be microwaves. All of these are components of John Hutchison's research.
Yeah.
And then added to that, when Dr. Wood and I first went on air in January 2008, that's 5 years ago now, 5 years ago, we went public with that information on the Ambrose Lane program. I actually went over to Washington, D.C. I was invited to go over there by a friend we've got over there, and we went on to Ambrose Lane's program. Within 16 hours of that broadcast going out, character assassinations started against John Hutchison. And people would not, if you read any pages on the internet, you would never find 9/11 and the Hutchison effect mentioned in the same paragraph without there being some ridicule or insult.
Yeah.
People would not talk about it, and it's still only talked about a little bit. And the reason why it's talked about a bit more is primarily because of what Judy's been doing on various radio shows, what Richard D. Hall has been doing by presenting this information on his radio program and helping people to get access to the book, which has been, in this country, primarily come through Richard D. Hall, and of course what I've been doing to sort of supply these books and also go on the odd podcast and radio interview and whatnot. Mm. And so now there is a little bit more awareness of this information, that it does all tie up, and it is not a theory. It's two, as Dr. Wood describes it, there are two sets of evidence she's got. She's got a set of evidence from the aftermath of the World Trade Center destruction, and of course the events from that were shown in the videos. And you've got a set of evidence from John Hutchison's experiments, which have been running since the early 80s. You know, we've got government documents about those experiments. We've got a letter from the Canadian government, from Chuck Cook, which says that the report on his on John Hutchison's research was classified by the Canadian government. So if this is just a guy hoaxing stuff, then why bother?
Why
they classifying the reports?
Yeah.
So we and further than that as well, I mentioned before about Thermite not going into a court submission. Well, John Hutchison actually submitted a court affidavit on behalf of Judy Wood's case, or in relation to Judy Wood's case, perhaps I should say, in 2007. I actually helped him write out that affidavit to get everything in order into sort of sequence. And that affidavit is on Judy Wood's website, and the court-stamped document is. So why would John Hutchison want to perjure himself in a court if what he was doing was untrue?
Yeah.
And so there's the difference for people. It's very, very stark, and all the data is public. It's all available. We don't have any deep throat sources. We don't have any people that have said, oh, you know, we know this, we know that, and we'll give you this information. We do have people who, for example, scientists that have read Judy Wood's book, but they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to discuss it publicly because of the effect it will have on their careers. But privately, they know that what is in the book is, in all the important details, correct. And that's coming from scientists that which we could, you know, we don't. They don't want to be associated with a public discussion of it.
I listened to Paul Laviolette talking to Mel Fabregas on the Veritas show.
Yeah.
And he actually brought up Judy Wood's work of what she, and the book. And he actually supported it. You know, he didn't dismiss it at all. And that was my first instance of being interested in it, because I know this guy is totally on a level and everybody should listen to him. And then I've seen it coming up more and more and more and more, and lots of people have been sending me this link, and I've been like, you know, it's like I've been avoiding getting involved in it because I'm thinking, well, there must be something to it. And when I fall down a rabbit hole, I could be gone for weeks, you know what I mean? You know, and that, you know, that was one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you, because I listen to you as well. You're one of the people that I listen to, because, you know, you don't make things up. You go on what you've got and what you can see, and you know to be true. So that's why, you know, I wanted to talk
good
to you.
Well, that's great. And, you know, one thing I should also mention, that why this is being covered up, why is there such a powerful cover up, you know, why are you only finding, you've been interested in 9/11, what, 5 years, is it? How long?
Since it happened, really, but I mean, I only got on the net in 2005, but I was in the 9/11 truth forum straight away.
So so I've said 2005, so that's what, it's 8 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and you're only sort of coming to this information now, right?
Yeah.
You know, so let's just mention that from your own experience. Mm. So, as I said, we put this information into the public domain in 2008, which is 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've been sending out DVDs of this stuff ever since then. For example, I mentioned we went on the Ambrose Lane thing, yeah? And I recorded that. We had a, you know, we took a little camera into the studio and we recorded the whole broadcast. We did 2 1-hour shows, and I thought, right, I'm going to make this into a DVD. So, you know, we had us just sitting in the studio talking to the callers and that, and then I put some pictures on top of it, and, you know, and that's been available. I think I finished doing that DVD something like, I don't know, it was 5 years ago, March 2005, I had that DVD ready. And yet, you've only now started to really come up on your radar screen.
Yeah.
So that shows you how successful the marginalisation of this information has been. Mm. Because you, as somebody who's really digging into this stuff, you only now sort of coming to get to grips with it in perhaps more of a sort of meaty way or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So that proves how successful the cover-up has been.
Absolutely. Because I actually do, you know, keep an interest in it. I'm not into it as much as I was, because I thought, well, where can we go from here now?
Yeah.
There's all the other sort of things that are coming out, holographic planes, and there's still no answers for the Pentagon or Tower 7, and, you know, it's like, God, you know.
There is a lot to it, that's right. But
yeah.
I just wanted to add to that, you know, not mean to sort of talk over you, but...
No, go for it.
The point about this is the energy connection. That is the one. You know, you get all these David Ray Griffin types, Kevin Barrett's, Stephen E. Jones, Richard Gage, all these guys, and nearly everyone, Tony Rook, you know, anyone, you can, Ian Henshaw, all of those guys, Tony Gosling, they will not talk about the energy connection to 9/11. They may, for example, talk about the oil, you know, the oil industry and the invasion of Afghanistan for the oil reasons, but they will not discuss that this Hutchinson effect is an energy phenomenon. They will not discuss that this, if you look at the evidence and go with it and study it, you will see that the Hutchinson effect appears to be connected to what's called cold fusion, which is this phenomenon which was discovered by Pons and Fleischmann, two electrochemists in the late 80s, and it appeared that they were getting more out of their experiment, sorry, more energy out of their experiment, you know, more watts of power were coming out than going in under certain circumstances. It was energy apparently coming from nowhere, potentially usable energy. And who was right there in the middle of that, mentioned on 100 pages of Dr. Eugene Mallow's book about cold fusion? Dr. Stephen E. Jones was right in the middle of all of that, all right? And you can go and read Dr. Mallow's book. I've read Dr. Mallow's book, and it's very, very interesting how he describes how they tried to crush cold fusion out of existence. Because the energy industry runs the whole planet. Bankers need energy. Governments need energy. Third world countries need energy. Pharmaceutical companies need energy. The underpinning power and framework is energy. Right? And once it becomes known that we can have for free as much energy as we like, then it's over for them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, and also once it becomes known, the key and vital thing which no one will talk about in the free energy movement, if you go to that from 9/11, they will not talk about the free energy technology having been turned into a weapon, which is exactly what's happened to it.
Well, that's what they do with everything, isn't
it? Yes, exactly. But nobody in the free energy community, or say nobody, very few people. We were very fortunate with the guys, to get to know the guys at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference, and they invited both Judy and myself to do a talk in Hilversum last November. And that's one of the few times where we've both been invited to an event. Dr. Judy did the sort of 9/11 stuff. She mentioned a bit about cold fusion, and then I sort of did a talk about the energy cover-up and how we can identify certain people like Edgar Mitchell, who appear to be good guys, but actually they're helping the cover-up of free energy technology and helping to collect information about those involved with it. So that's what people have now got to start to get to grips with, and they're not going to do it by looking at most of the standard websites, because most of them are co-opted and controlled, and they are not connecting these important dots, which will give you the, you know, maybe not the full picture, but you'll get closer to the full picture from making these connections. You know, as I say, Ian Crane won't talk about it, Ian Henshaw won't talk about it, Tony Gosling won't talk about it. The only people, to my knowledge, that will talk about it, one of the few people, is Richard D. Hall. He's one of the only people that will talk about these clear and obvious connections in the way that I've just described them. Mm. And again, anybody can go and look at the published research, public documents, and you'll see that everything I'm telling you is true. And the vital thing to understand is that when 9/11 gets properly and fully exposed in terms of how the World Trade Center is destroyed, the people that are running the planet will not have a leg to stand on in terms of any propaganda that they want to give out about, you know, global warming, energy, terrorism. That's all gone.
Yeah,
it's all completely trashed once the Judy Wood understanding of things in terms of the evidence that she's collected becomes widely known. And in fact, we had a very good quote from somebody. I'll see if I can find it. One of the chaps that did an interview with Judy last year. You might even know the chap. I'll see if I can find this quote.
But we've got 4 minutes.
Okay.
So.
All right. Yeah, I can find it within that time. okay. And so let's just see which one it'll be. I think it's the Vancouver, isn't it? Yeah, so, but are there any questions? Has anybody got any questions from the chat room or anything?
I'm not sure. I'll have a little look. I flogged off from them a minute
ago. Okay,
I've just had my mind completely blown now, because it's a totally different perspective. And it actually kind of, all of how, you know, what happened, my research and all of the things that I'm interested in, I kind of know how that could happen. I know that there's absolutely everything in place for that to be a very real thing, you know, technology-wise, even the means to get it up there legally, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, my thing was Rendlesham Forest and all sorts of strange technologies that they've been testing, all of it, antigraphitics, it all ties in, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's how I sort of like fell into sort of Paula Virilet's work, and so this is not, to me, far fetched.
No, that's right. I mean, it sounds it initially when you hear the idea of it, but when you go follow the path and, you know, put it all together, and it's not an easy process. You know, I mean, obviously I've saying things quite emphatically and stuff like that, but but it's because I've been studying this information. For certainly from Dr. Wood's evidence, I've been studying that for sort of, you know, 6 years now, 7 years almost, I suppose you might even say.
Yeah.
So that's a long time, you know. So you're not going to get necessarily to where I am, you know, overnight.
No, but I have a good understanding of a different. You know, I've come in from a different doorway.
Sure. I'm more
the
talking
same room. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm more talking to the audience perhaps than yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that you've researched a lot, so I wasn't meaning sort of you personally. I should have said one. You know. But this quote from Maurice Herman, he said, Dr. Judy Wood being victorious in her message to the public results in the entire overthrow of our ruling elite. I wonder if she knows that and the consequent forces aligned against her. And if you read my book, 9/11 Finding the Truth, you'll see a little sort of thumbnail of a few of those forces and how they operate.
90 seconds.
Right, we've got to go. Right.
Okay.
Andrew's website is checktheevidence.com. Get on there. All the information is on there. It's a brilliant website. It's so packed with stuff, loads of documents and everything. Andrew, you've been an absolutely brilliant guest. I actually feel like I've learned a lot tonight. And, you know, it's got my brain firing off in another direction with all the other stuff that I do. You know, it all completely ties in. It does. So thank you very much. And hopefully we'll have you on again.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. Just we can sort something out.
Thanks very much.
Okay, then.
All right, guys. Thanks, guys, in the chat room. And next week, it'll be from 10 o'clock. I won't be broadcasting from 11 anymore. Woohoo! I can get to bed an hour earlier. Right. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. I'll see you all soon. Bye.
Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.